You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Grace Cho immigrated to the U.S. as a baby. She grew up in a small rural town in Washington State. She was the daughter of a white American father and a Korean mother. When Grace was a teenager, her mom experienced the onset of schizophrenia. And Grace's new memoir, Tastes Like War, which was a 2021 National Book Award finalist, chronicles her time trying to reconnect with her mom, and she does this through food and conversation, but also a search into the history of her mother. And Grace has been kind enough to join us to talk more about this. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we have to start the conversation by giving full disclosure here. Grace and I grew up in the same town in Washington. In fact, we went to high school together. We were in the same graduating class. And Grace, we'll talk about, I think, a little bit more of our experiences growing up in Chehalis. But first, I want to start with your mom, because your memories of her when you were young, as you write in the book, were of this woman who was, I think, you know, lonely in many ways, right? Trying to fit into this new society. But at the same time, she was making a path for herself. And can you talk a little bit about that? Because you, in the book, you talk about how she started foraging for food, but she even would sometimes throw, you know, a great party in order to kind of really, I think, be in charge of her own destiny.
Yeah. And I don't know at what point she made the decision that she was going to carve out a space for herself, or if it was something that was just instinctive. But what I remember was that at the very beginning, she seemed to be very sad and, had this profound sense of isolation living in Chehalis, mm-hmm. especially because my father was a merchant marine and he was gone for 3 months at a time. And so especially during those periods, it seemed as if we were all alone and my mom didn't have a whole lot of a support system. But at some point, she did start to take charge, as you said, and to really find these ways of being resourceful in this town, of creating allies. And so one of the ways in which she did this was by hosting these cocktail parties for the entire public school system in Chehalis, where she'd invite my teachers and my future teachers, the administrators, and just throw this lavish party that she would prepare for as if it were the most important thing that was ever going to happen. And so in that way, people got to know her, or at least the people mm-hmm. who were important to her got to know her. And then a few years later, she started a foraging business. And so as I wrote in the book, originally her foraging really was motivated by her desire to find certain ingredients to use in Korean mm-hmm. cooking that she couldn't find on her own. But then once she started to do it, she realized that the forested areas around Chehalis were sort of a gold mine in terms of finding things that she could sell. So it started with blackberries, where she just sort of happened upon a blackberry patch and realized that this was something that American women would be very interested in, because she noticed that they like to bake, you know, because that's something that's a distinctly American thing from a Korean perspective. Because yeah. in Korea, most people don't have ovens, so it's not part of the traditional cuisine. And so once she found this blackberry patch, she put an ad in the paper to sell fresh or frozen wild blackberries. And it seemed like literally overnight, our house was just full of blackberries. And there were all these people coming to visit her to buy the wild blackberries. And she even became known as the Blackberry Lady at some point.
And I think it's important to talk about Chehalis. Mm-hmm. This is the town, as I mentioned, you and I both grew up in. You moved there as a toddler. I moved there when I was 8 years old. We moved from Portland. My mom actually grew up in that area, and that's why we ended up moving back. You were a biracial child in a predominantly white, blue-collar town. Mm-hmm. And what's been interesting to me, Grace, is that since your book has been published, those of us who went to high school together have, you know, through social media, have have talked about how so many of us felt isolated. So many of us, if you did not fit some kind of stereotypical norm in that town, it felt ostracizing. With that said, I'm white. There was a privilege with that.
Yeah.
You in the book write about, you know, not just your experience, Grace, but like your mom's experiences with, you know, discrimination. And it is, I think it's something where, you know, having grown up there when you're a kid, you don't necessarily understand it. But I think you write so eloquently about really the, even maybe the not said discrimination that's in that area of Washington.
Right. Yeah. So it's interesting because, you know, I think at the beginning of elementary school, I did sort of identify myself as someone who was mixed race. I didn't use that term mixed race or biracial. I think I said I'm half Korean. But quickly I learned that my white half didn't really matter because I was seen as an other. And so that experience of being othered sort of dominated my memories of elementary school and high school as well, of sort of being one of the few Asian kids in the town. And, you know, as we got older, there were more Asians that came in, but it didn't really change that experience for me. I think it just sort of, you know, as we grew into adolescence, the nature of the bias sort of transformed, you know, so I experienced things that were more akin to what we would now call microaggressions, right? You know, so I gave an example of someone saying, well, oh, I can't stand the Chinks and the Japs because they're taking over everything. Oh, but I'm not talking about you because you're different, right? So something like that that would not really be acceptable in 2022 was so much the norm back in the 1980s. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I don't think that that's unique to Chehalis, but it was very dominant in Chehalis in the way that people looked at those of us who were part of a minority.
Well, you even talk in the book, I mean, you write in the book about an incident in elementary school where you, basically you and another girl, if I'm remembering the passage correctly, went around to the other classrooms to kind of talk about your so-called heritage, but this just would not happen in this day and age. Can you describe that scene in the book?
Yeah, I mean, it was me and one of the kids who had been adopted by one of the families in Chehalis, and the teachers asked us to go around to different classrooms to sort of give a lesson about Korea. And they asked my mom to join, and she brought some Korean food. She brought a dish called japchae, which is a noodle dish. And, you know, when my mom tried to serve the food to the kids, one of them started yelling that they were made of worms. And so my mother was just livid. I mean, she had to try to repress it because these were only children, but it was a very humiliating experience for her. And so it's really interesting because I, you know, recently took some Korean food to my son's classroom, and it was just a completely different experience where almost all of the kids in his class, even if they were not Korean or not Asian, had eaten Korean food before. And so it wasn't something that was really exotic the way that it was in Chehalis. And, you know, the other thing I can say about that event is that we were clearly called upon to be these sort of native informants when we were the only Koreans present in the elementary school. You know, that wouldn't really happen so frequently today.
You wouldn't be taking a child around to other classrooms, and almost in a way it felt, as I was reading it, Grace, almost as a violation, even though I know that that was not the intention.
Yeah, it wasn't the intention. And, you know, in some ways, I think that maybe the other child felt special in being able to talk, but it you know, looking back on it through an adult lens, I do see it as sort of a way of exoticizing us, you know, and sort of looking at us as a curiosity, and it sort of like, you know, evokes the whole history of, you know, natural history museums in which you put Native people on display. So looking back at the memory, it feels a little bit like that.
So I want to move to when you were a teenager. This is when things really begin to change. You notice a shift in your mom's mental health. And you know, what's interesting to me in this time, because this is when I met you, and, you know, you and I didn't necessarily run in the same circles, but what I remember of you was just how chic you were and how put together you were and how you dressed so well and you were so smart. And, you know, when you got into Brown University, I mean, I remember when this happened and being so impressed, but thinking like, of course, someone like Grace would get into Brown University. Yet all of this time, as I talk about this, your mother was you know, being diagnosed with schizophrenia. And here you are trying to juggle all of this. Your parents' marriage is volatile. As you mentioned, your dad's not home all the time. And you're trying to find help for your mom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, she did not get an official diagnosis for another 8 years. But the year I turned 15 was when I noticed that there was something wrong. You know, like, it originally started with her feeling like people were out to get her, sort of what you would consider symptoms of paranoia. And it wasn't so far-fetched to me at the time, because she had actually experienced some things like that in Chehalis, but increasingly it started to involve politicians, you know, that the governor, the president were monitoring her activities. She started to become suspicious of a lot of people who she had previously had either good or neutral relationships with. And so that's when I went to the library at our high school to check out some books about mental illness. And so I myself actually, you know, with no credentials whatsoever, diagnosed her with paranoid schizophrenia. And I went to the local community mental health care center to talk to someone about it. And the counselor I spoke with said, he basically said, "I'm sorry, but there's nothing we can do for your mom." And it was really devastating to me that no one was willing to help me. And also in my family, no one believed me that this was happening. And I think it was, you know, I think I only talked to Jenny about it, she's a character in the book. She was my best friend from elementary school all through high school. And she witnessed some of it as well. But it was really terrifying to have to see this and not know what to do as a young adolescent. And, you know, you didn't see that side of me because I hid it pretty well. And I'm guessing that some people in town did know about it because, you know, because people talk in small towns, and my mom did sort of lash out at some people, I think, as a result of what was happening to her mental health.
I think in the book too, what's interesting is, as you mentioned, it takes, you know, another 8 years for your mom to be diagnosed. As you go off to college and move back east, you kind of start on this journey to figure out why your mom, got schizophrenia, her mental health, and where this came from. And what I appreciated in the book is that you write so eloquently about, you know, these are your memories. This is what you remember. And you even take us back to South Korea when your mom met your dad at an American military base. Mm-hmm. And you write about how, well, you know, women who were on the base were only there for a couple of reasons. And take us to this point where then you learn something about your mom. And all of a sudden things maybe start clicking as to there was such trauma mm-hmm. that we now know in 2022 that trauma is an adverse childhood effect. It can highly impact someone's mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, in college, I started to just think much more broadly about social issues. And I suspected that there was more to my mom's family history than I had known about. I mean, I actually knew mm-hmm. almost nothing about her family history because whenever I asked her about her life in Korea, she just sort of shut down and ignored me. But then it was right before my 23rd birthday. It was the day before New Year's Eve, 1994, when a member of my family actually revealed to me that she had been a sex worker in Korea at the US military base. And so for the rest of my adult life, I operated under the assumption that that was true. The thing is, I don't have any real proof of it. I did speak to a couple other family members after that revelation who seemed to confirm that it was true. I mean, they didn't deny it. But what was interesting is that they actually never spoke the words sex work or sex industry or prostitute. And so there has always been this sort of ambiguity around it, and also this taboo around speaking those words. So I sort of moved forward in my adult life doing research that both focused on the system of state-sanctioned sex work for U.S. troops in Korea, mm-hmm. but also the uncertainty around it, and the taboos and the shame and secrecy that the women who have worked in that system have had to carry with them. And, in Korea at that time, even if a woman didn't work in that system, if she had not been a sex worker at all, but maybe met a boyfriend or a husband through some other channels, if he was American, that woman then got branded as a prostitute. And so, I've always wanted to sort of make my work a tribute to all of those women who have had that sort of stigma attached to them, who have been shamed or belittled because of a presumed history as a sex worker.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I found this is what I really appreciated in your book is that you, from an academic standpoint, you've written academic literature mm-hmm. into research around this. And, in the book, I mean, you do write that I think from your academic background, from the research that you have done into mm-hmm. South Korea and immigrants like your mom coming to the United States, that there are kind of assumptions that you can make in regards to, well, my mother could have been a sex worker. I mean, all of these pieces of the puzzle fit together. But yeah. I think you're clear in the book that it's not, yes, she was. It was. Mm-hmm. So I think I think you were very good about looking into the trauma and what could have caused that trauma.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that the women who have worked in that system of sex work around the US bases have had to hide their pasts. And that secrecy mm-hmm. sort of gets reinforced by all sorts of different institutions, including the family, including the government, right? And so I think that even the psychic pressure of having to keep that secret is something that can lead to the kind of trauma that would damage someone's psyche. And so that's a big emphasis mm-hmm. of my work in both my first academic book and in my memoir, because I would like to see people, become destigmatized from all of these labels that have been attached to them.
So as your mom, as the years went on, you became, your mom lived at your brother's over his, they kind of made like a mother-in-law suite over the garage. Mm-hmm. She lived there, but you would come and you would cook it's really, I think, beautiful in a lot of ways how we started talking about how your mother foraged and she made all of these Korean foods and how she would go to Seattle and she brought home all this cabbage one time. Mm-hmm. And And so you almost found your way back to her before she passed away through food. But it also seemed in the book to happen kind of organically.
Yeah, it did. Yeah. I mean, so as there were more, I guess, more demands on me to sort of help with certain aspects of my mom's care, you know, I often didn't really know how to do that because I lived in a different state. I was beginning a doctoral program at the time that she moved to New Jersey. For part of that time, I was on the tenure track. But, you know, I did go visit her on the weekends and cook for her. And for a time, she also lived with me in Queens when I had an apartment with my ex. But, you know, there was sort of this journey over the course of cooking for her, where at the beginning, she also didn't accept my cooking. And eventually she did. But we got into a lot of arguments about it because she didn't want to eat it for various reasons. So some of it was because she thought I was wasting my time when I should be focusing on school. So that's sort of been a theme throughout my relationship with her, is that, you know, you shouldn't be doing that. You should be studying instead. But when she finally started to accept my cooking, at first I would just cook for her what I felt like eating or what I thought that she might like to eat, because I was very interested in culinary education myself. I actually went to culinary school for a short time as well. And she did enjoy those dishes because they were new to her. But then after a while, she started to ask for Korean food. And she asked for that consistently, even asking for things that I myself had never tasted. And so over the course of the last few years of her life, when she lived in the apartment above my brother's garage, she taught me to cook my grandmother's recipes. And so it was sort of this amazing experience that allowed me to have access to a past that I had never had access to before. And I think for her, it was a way of instructing me not just how to cook, but how to provide comfort for her, because these were sort of like her ultimate comfort foods, because they were the foods that her mother cooked for her. And, you know, it was, I guess, not only a way for me to find my way back to my mother, my childhood mother, but also a way for her to find a way back to her mother. So it was like this moment of intergenerational healing that was quite profound.
I don't want to take much time with this, but I do need to note that you've gotten some criticism about your book from certain family members who, A, were upset that you did not interview them, B, questioning your memory, saying that certain things are not true. This is not a work of nonfiction. It should be fiction. I have to say, I am one of 10 children. We all have different memories. I mean, you could ask all of us and we would all remember something differently. We all viewed our home life differently, even though we grew up in the same house. With that said, you know, what has it been like to have that criticism? But also, I mean, you know, in some ways, some people would say, well, you should interview family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, I've said in other interviews that the kind of relationship I have with those family members is not one that would allow for any of that kind of dialogue. Because, you know, I'm revealing things that they'd always made clear that they didn't want me to reveal. And so going to them to interview them would have just resulted in them trying to shut down the writing altogether. And, you know, I feel that the story is really important to tell the story about my mom, which is not just a story about my mom, but it's a much bigger story about how, as a society, we reckon with the social causes of mental illness, how we reckon with the role of the U.S. In, you know, wars abroad. And so it's much bigger than any of the characters or any of the events in the book. And, you know, what I wanted to say also about memory and perception, like, I think you're absolutely right that every member of the family is going to have a totally different usually a totally different recollection of exactly right. what happened. And I think that if, you know, if you and all of your siblings had the same memories and perceptions, then that would be a little questionable, right? And even whether or not you remember something at all is going to vary a lot from one person to the next based on a lot of different factors. So just because someone doesn't remember something doesn't mean that it didn't happen. And, you know, there was even an example in my book. There was a scene from that New Year's Eve, 1994, which I shared with the two mm-hmm. friends who were there with me that night. And their recollections were so starkly different from one another, where one friend remembered so many things about me that night, including my state of mind. She remembered the dialogue that I had written in the book, my mood, because that was sort of the beginning of my journey towards wanting to understand my mother's past. Whereas the other friend mm-hmm. didn't really remember anything about me, but she remembered that Mark Anthony was wearing a Tweety Bird cap at the performance that we attended, right? So it was like she remembered those little details that I would not have picked up on.
Yeah. That's what I think is so fascinating about memory. Yeah. Yeah. Before I let you go, Grace, what is your hope? What is your take? What do you hope people take away from reading this book?
Well, you know, one thing is that I hope that they'll rethink the concept of mental illness, not as something that resides in the individual or that is, you know, that's not necessarily caused by a broken brain, but rather that it's the manifestation of a social problem in the body of the individual. And I'd like people to think about how the people who bear the brunt of those social illnesses are, that it varies based on how that person is racialized, based on how they're gendered. And to really think about this idea of a collective history that is larger than the individual. So in a lot of ways, it's not really about my mom, but I also want people to really recognize her as a person who was complex, but fully human, you know? So I want people to be able to see that she was this extraordinary person, and to be able to see that without whitewashing her history. And at the same time, even though I think she was an extraordinary person, she represents so many other women out there who have had similar experiences, but who have been hiding their pasts. And so I really just want those people to be honored.
I want to thank you so much for the time to talk about this. It has been lovely to reconnect with you after all of these years.
So it's been great reconnecting with you too as well. Yeah. Thank you so much.
It really has been. Absolutely. We've been talking with Grace Cho. She is an associate professor of sociology and anthropology at the College of Staten Island. She is also the author of her new memoir, it's called Taste Like War. It was a 2021 National Book Award finalist for nonfiction. It is available right now. I want to thank all of you for joining us today. Our producers are Frankie Barhill and Samantha Wright. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.